This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, I'm Caroline Oh.
And I'm Arlene Weber.
You're listening to a new series called Parenting Adventures, a show that brings brutally honest discussions about parenting to the fore. Now, today's episode is a tough one to address. It's a topic that's so difficult that, for the most part, many people avoid talking about it altogether. It's most often a topic accompanied by raw emotions, vulnerability, and grief, lots of grief. And while there are a number of conversations that are inherently difficult, I think one of the most difficult conversations, however, might just be talking about the end of a life, especially when it involves the passing of a child.
Yes, it's difficult to talk about the death of a child, especially with parents who've lost their children. But you know, I thought this would be an important topic to cover because in speaking with parents who've had the misfortune of having to go through this awful experience, I realized that there's actually a need to talk about that loss. There's a need to acknowledge that it's happened and a need for an outlet to express that grief. It's a very important part of the healing process for grieving parents.
So in keeping with the premise for this series, we're going to be exploring the complexities surrounding the death of a child this evening, why grieving parents find it difficult to speak about it, why their well-meaning friends can't seem to find the appropriate language to communicate their sorrow, how detaching oneself from that grief could do more harm than good. Dr. Denise Turner joins Arlene on the line this evening. She's a lecturer in the Department of Social Work, Wellbeing and Social Care at the University of Sussex in the UK. Her area of work explores the experience of and cultural responses to child death. Her research includes unexpected child deaths and the experiences of grieving parents in that situation.
Thanks for joining us, Denise. Let's just get straight into it. Death is never a simple conversation to have, especially when it's the death of a child. The reaction seems to be the same all over. We just clam up immediately.
Very often, this is an experience that's happened to people, so they want to talk about it. Otherwise, it becomes a sort of guilty secret. So I think it's about finding ways in which people can share these stories. And they often won't share the stories because they're afraid of upsetting other people. And other people are frightened of hearing the stories because they're afraid of responding in the wrong way. And so I think what we need is a cultural permission, if you like, a way of sharing these stories that is okay for people. But on a wider spectrum, I think that people are not prepared really for the deaths of children in the West, because there is a Western cultural mythology that we've conquered death in some kind of way. So death only belongs to the elderly, that death can be managed and controlled in some kind of way, that perhaps if we eat our five a day and go jogging and go to the gym, that somehow in some way we'll defy death. And so death can, I think, be seen almost as a failure rather than a natural event that will happen to all of us. So when a child dies, that then becomes a bigger failure of some kind. It becomes more unacceptable because it's a death out of time. It's a death that we don't expect. And if we struggle with the deaths of older people, then we're really going to struggle culturally with the deaths of children.
Is there really one way or one specific way to deal with the loss of a child? And will that help lessen the pain?
What my research showed is that people deal with the death of a child in all sorts of different ways, and all those ways are unique to them and unique to the circumstances, because there's no one death of a child. Children die at different ages. Some people have a child die and they have no other children, and that's a very different experience as well. So there is no one experience, and therefore there is no one way of dealing with it. What my research showed was that people find it helpful if they can make some kind of meaning out of the experience, so that child's life is carried on in some way, still has a kind of meaningful contribution to the world. And for some people, taking part in my research was was their meaningful contribution. It was a way of making meaning for them. You know, radio programs like yours, where this experience is openly talked about, or, you know, through responsible kind of media contributions, that, that those are ways of breaking down the taboo around this subject so that it becomes less frightening for people in some kind of way, I would say. And I think that, you know, I think that breaks down that fear of blame as well. Parents, when they've had a child die, will often blame themselves, even though most often they couldn't actually have done anything about it. They'll blame themselves, and there is a lot of blame circulating, whereas actually sometimes just bad things happen, and we have to do what we can with them and give each other permissions to share those stories in whatever way.
So in speaking with parents who have lost their children, apparently the most common advice is pull yourself together and move on. And that kind of advice, it surprised me that that's normal. That's the kind of advice anyone can dish out and everyone is supposed to receive, because it seems so emotionless, so cold, and it's not exactly an easy thing to do.
So I don't think it's possible to sort of, the trite phrase, to get over it. I don't think you get over it. I think that from what I've seen, it is possible to sort of assimilate that child's life into your family narrative and into yourself, and to make meaning from it in some way. So a lot of the people in my research would, they joined organisations where they helped other people, having had that experience themselves. They wanted to be able to do something that would make it better for other people. So they joined charities, or they ran for charities or whatever, where actually they kept their child's name alive and they gave some kind of meaning to that child's life by trying to help other people and to improve the experience. So that wasn't them moving on from it, but it was them making some meaning from it, and perhaps moving on in the sense that they moved on from the immediate grief that surrounded the experience. So I think the sort of pull yourself together and get over it narrative isn't a helpful one, because, you know, that child was there, they were a living being, they were part of your life, they're never going to go away.
How does losing a child affect family relationships?
There is a significant body of research that says that the death of a child has a very detrimental effect quite often on relationships, particularly where partners find it difficult to speak to each other. So where their grief becomes quite isolated and they're unable to share that with each other. But in many of the relationships of people within my research, there was actually strength in their shared experience as well. But it very much depended on their support networks and their capacity to talk to each other. And I think in male-female relationships, there is a tendency that I saw in my research, without generalising, for men to perhaps bottle up a bit, not speak about it, and for women to want to speak about it, and then that could become an issue between them. But again, I think there's no one size fits all here. People deal with it very differently. But the commonality is probably the ability to share what's happened and to support each other, which isn't always easy.
So Denise, in doing my research for the show, I have spoken with parents who have lost their children. I've read a lot of articles. You know, it ranged from babies to teenagers to young adults, and the causes of the death were varied as well. It included miscarriages, stillborns, accidents, substance abuse. And I found that people, in reacting to it, they seem to think that grief should come in varying degrees, you know, depending on how the death occurred. Like, if it was a fetus or a stillborn, the assumption was that the grief was tolerable and that grieving parents would get over it quickly, and therefore the sympathy level could be low, you know, so to speak. Or if the child was a toddler or a teenager, she or he would have spent a number of years alive. So in that instance, the grief would be greater and people would sympathize more. I mean, is that common? And why do we make those assumptions? What exactly are they based on?
I think that there are almost what you could think about as hierarchies of grief. And so people will say things like, well, you know, you haven't had a, you've only had a baby die, or you've, you know, at least you still had other children, or those kind of comments are very common. And it is an interesting thing. I think it's a way that, again, people deal with their particular pain. They often feel that their pain is worse than somebody else's, or for people that make those kind of comments, perhaps they just simply don't understand it. They don't understand that it's the death of that hope, you know, the death of all the plans that you were making, and the death of that investment that you'd made in the future, which has also gone. So I think, again, that comes back to this, what I was saying before, really, about education and finding space to tell these stories, so that people are encouraged to understand, so that they will think about those comments more, and perhaps not set out these kind of hierarchies. Everybody's experience is unique to them, and their feelings about it are unique to them. But I think, again, that comes back to education.
I think the truth is that I knew when her time was close. And I think it was the last 2 years that I could see her getting really skinny, and she was getting bed sores. But emotionally, it took a toll on me because I cried. I just cried nonstop, and I was too scared to be close to her, because at some point I was scared it's going to be harder on me. You know, when you love someone so much and you're going, oh God, if I'm too close to her, it's just going to hit me really hard, and can I cope?
That's Mahaini, a mother who lost her 18-year-old daughter, Marissa, to cancer. That was a very heartbreaking journey. She shares her story with us next on Parenting Adventures, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition's Parenting Adventures with me, Caroline Oh, alongside mother of two, Arlene Weber. Now, we're speaking about dealing with the death of a child this evening and how people react, or rather don't react, to such tragedy.
Yes, that non-reaction seems to be a universal response to the loss of a child. It's so disconcerting that often people just choose to avoid it. So earlier in the show, we spoke with a doctor whose area of work revolves around child death. Dr. Denise Turner, a lecturer with the University of Sussex, explained that when a child passes on, parents do need to talk about it. They do need for people around them to acknowledge that it happened. She's a strong advocate of having those difficult discussions, in hopes that the more parents share their stories, the more we break down the fear and taboo surrounding the conversation of child deaths.
So joining us on the show are two mothers who believe wholeheartedly in that approach. They've come forward to speak with us this evening in hopes that it would help other parents suffering in silence. Mahaini Mustafa, mother of four children, she lost her eldest daughter, Marissa, to brain cancer last year. She has a book published titled Caring for Marissa, which she wrote as part of her grieving process.
So Mahaini and I, we were neighbours for some years, and in that short time, I witnessed how closely knit her family was. And I saw her in so many roles, despite the challenges that were laid, you know, in front of them. She was a mother, she was a wife, she was a caregiver. She was a woman who knew that she was going to lose her child one day. Her strength was incredible, to say the least.
Marissa was diagnosed with brain tumour at 4, and the doctor says that it was inoperable and nothing could be done. So basically, the moment she was diagnosed, we were given 2 years and asked to go home immediately, saying the prognosis was just not good, we couldn't do anything. So we actually looked for alternative and all that. So finally, she had 2 major surgeries done in Australia. But other than that, actually, we didn't do anything. She couldn't respond to chemo or radiation or all sorts of things that nothing could be medically done, but surgically only.
But she went beyond the 2 years that the doctor gave you.
We had 14 lovely years with her. She was amazing. And I think the main reason was that I think we filled her life with love. anything. We treated her as normal. We didn't treat her as that girl who had brain tumor, who was disabled, and mind you, she was disabled her whole life. And she was on wheelchair, on adult strollers. And yet, I mean, looking back at it, when I look at her pictures and all that, and I can see she was still filled with happiness and laughter, and she lived quite full. I think we made sure that she had a full life. We tried our best to do that for her. But we never really went into, you know, deep discussions about what should be done with her. She knew. We told her she had brain tumor, but she never really wanted. I think it was also her nature to not talk about it. Because whenever she talked about it, she would shut down. She would ignore us. And so, you know, she would say, no, you decide. Whatever you think that you need to do, you decide. And we always say, you know, it's your life. It's your decision. We must give that choice to you as well as she grew bigger. And it was always, no, I think you knew what is best for me, she said. That was harder than her, actually, because there was she didn't like to be stared at. And you know, that's another thing. When we go out here, everyone looks. Everyone comments without thinking. It's like, why is she on the wheelchair and the brother is, you know, because she's the elder one. And the brother is the one that's walking and she's on the wheelchair. And sometimes I wish I could give them a long speech, but I'm thinking, okay, some people are not worth talking to and some things are not worth explaining to the other person.
You just have to pick your battles.
Yeah, I just pick. Some of them will be, but I've met some lovely ones who would come up and be very kind to her and all that. So I'm thinking, okay, so, you know, you keep your life to a circle where it's manageable, where it will not hurt you. So just control that. And that is in your control, actually, in every person's control. But I wanted to write that book mainly for that. I think the truth is that I knew when her time was close. And I think it was the last 2 years that I could see her getting really skinny and she was getting bed sores. But emotionally, it took a toll on me because I cried. I just cried nonstop. And I was too scared to be close to her because at some point I was scared it was going to be harder on me. You know, when you love someone so much and you're going, oh God, if I'm too close to her, it's just going to hit me really hard. And can I cope? I actually asked myself that. And there would be endless texts to Mazit saying, you know, she's getting worse. I can see that she's not feeling too good, where she's just down. And she herself did not speak much towards the end. And, you know, she's just like fed up with life. You can see it's like the life when there was no meaning. And being a mom, you know, I'm quite a fighter. So I told Marisa, you have to eat. If not, you're going to get weak. You have to do this. Let's book tickets and go somewhere. You know, we plan everything. And she would go along with him. But in my heart, I think I knew. I knew that she her time was limited. And I think she wanted to say, but she herself cannot say it. Because, I mean, how do you tell? Because I knew she always worried about me. She would say, Mom, don't worry, Mommy. You go out. You need to do this. You need some time of your own. But I think on the day she passed away, she knew. I think she knew. I remember specifically on the day Marisa passed, you know, the doctor actually told her that our option was this too. Do you want her to pass away at home or in the hospital? And she was already on the oxygen. And I think for me, because I'm with her all the time and I've already thought, okay, she's not living. She's alive, but she's not living. So what's the whole purpose? I mean, if it was me, I'll be having a standing, you know, order like, okay, if I'm on the machine, just pull it out, you know, because I'll be a burden to everyone else. And I want to live. But I think in some ways, Mazit, for that matter, wanted to say, should we try? And she actually asked me, should we try? And I understand. I understood when he said he wanted to try. Because as parents, we always want to try. We will never feel that we've done enough. And letting go is a hard thing. Especially when, for us, we supposedly had that option of leaving her, putting her on a breathing machine for however long. But that defeats the whole purpose. And I'm saying, no, we have to let her go. That was hard, saying letting her go.
You know, with Marisa's diagnosis that you received very early on your own accord, did you try to prepare for the end?
The truth is no, actually. I read, I actually did go online, I researched on her particular tumour, on caregiving, and I actually went on online support groups from overseas. I joined them and I decided in the end, it's me. I'm the one who's living with her. I should know better and I must be confident in knowing that what I do is right. Because sometimes it's, you know, it's good to read about them just to know roughly what it's about, but I think all in all, only you and your child will know. So I actually discussed with Marissa all along from when she was young, what would you like to do? It starts with little things. Would you prefer to take this medication in the morning or afternoon? It was never, you take this now. I have to remember she's the one that's ill. I'm just her caregiver, so I have to be sensitive to what she wants and what she needs. You know, you make her life as easy as possible. Don't make it difficult. It's already difficult for her.
And in seeing to her needs as you went along with no help, essentially, you're doing this all on your own.
Yes.
Did you have people around you who tell you, Oina Mahaini, this is wrong what you're doing. I think you should be doing it this way. Did you have a lot of those comments and how did you deal with them?
Lots, actually, lots. It's, I think, part of our culture that everyone feels that they know what is right. And I think in life, not only with having a sick child, there's no right and wrong. It's hard to say because everyone is different. Everyone deals with things differently. So I had many of those, like, you know, how can you not fight hard enough? Why aren't you taking her overseas and getting the surgeries? And, you know, first of all, it's easy to say, but financial factor is one. And secondly, I knew Marissa didn't want it because I always asked her. And I said, Marissa, do you want to do this? She will say, not this one, mommy. I don't want something aggressive. Can we do something less aggressive? What people didn't know was I always spoke to her. She was the main person. So I always feel, let's not forget that, you know? And let's not forget about the other siblings as well. Like, okay, what do you think? What do you think? Over dinner or something. Have that conversation because outsiders, people who are not in the family, doesn't really know actually. And everyone's dying to tell us, we're not doing enough. You're going to regret it if you don't try. And I'm like, okay, if I regret it, it'll be my regret. I have to live with it. Let it be something that I have to live with it. I know I'm going to do my best. She's my child like any other mom. You're going to give your child the best.
So you wrote Caring for Marissa shortly after she passed. Tell us about it.
I wrote about it because I wanted, actually the truth is I wanted the other mothers to read about it, to be able to express the so that you have no fear in feeling, there's nothing wrong with feeling all this, there's no fear in expressing, just because you feel sadness doesn't mean you've not moved on. I've moved on, honestly, but I still remember her and I remind my kids to about their sister. So the book is about that mainly, I think, for mothers and people in my situation, and about her, because Marissa was just an amazing, you know, young girl until she turned 18, who was the easiest person to take care of. You know, to me, she was never a burden. She was never difficult and she never made life hard for me.
What would you say to mothers out there, fathers out there, children out there who have either lost a sibling, lost a parent, and they are judged by others around them? What would you say to them?
Selectively choose who's important and whom you feel can help you make the right decision in regards to your life. And believe in yourself. I always feel that. You know, be firm about what you are, about what you want for your child, for you, because the best person that can make the decision is you. And culture, you can't help it. Everyone's going to tell you something. So how do you do it? How do you be strong? Find it. There's no way around it. And you must give yourself that time as well to focus on you. If you lose yourself and your sense of self, you're going to lose everything else. So don't think, oh, I don't think I can do that. You can.
And it was quite awful because I was sitting in this silent room by myself and I knew that just a few meters away was the body of my first child. But she was just beautiful and just perfectly formed. Tiny fingers, just such a gorgeous little thing. But no cries, just still, like a sleeping baby.
More on parenting adventures after this. BFM 89.9.
Banish fraudulent maneuvers. BFM 89.9.
Mm-hmm.
Good evening. This is the Evening Edition. I'm Caroline Oh, together with Arlene Weber, and you're listening to Parenting Adventures, a show that brings brutally honest discussions about parenting to the fore. Now, this evening, we're speaking about the grieving process of parents who have lost a child and trying to understand how conversations are a vital part of that process. Now, earlier, we heard from Haini Mustafa, who spoke about losing her eldest daughter, Marissa, to cancer last year. As she was candid about her grief, her struggles, and even the thoughtlessness of those around her at the time.
Yeah, you know, and it's those things that really, they really piss me off. I really get affected by people who are just insensitive with their comments when they're talking to, you know, parents who have lost their children. I don't understand how and why people think that grief over the death of a child is measured based on a situation. I remember telling someone off for dismissing a miscarriage as quote-unquote, not so tragic as compared to losing a living, healthy child. That kind of logic is complete bullshit, if you ask me. The death of a child, whether she or he was growing in your womb for 10 weeks, or if the child passed away in an accident or was ill, it all amounts to the same painful grief.
And it happens more often than we care to acknowledge, as described by Dr. Denise Turner earlier on the show. We also spoke with Mahaini Mustafa, who lost her eldest daughter, Marissa, to cancer just over a year ago. Now, we're now joined by our colleague and friend, Juliet Jacobs. Juliet and her husband lost their baby girl at 26 weeks. Now, for all of us, her friends, you know, it came as a shock when we heard the news and just so horribly heartbreaking.
I was having what my doctor called a textbook pregnancy. Everything was going along swimmingly. I was going to have a girl. She was my firstborn. She was going to be my firstborn. So what happened was I was about 26 weeks pregnant already. And so obviously, you know, when you're 26 weeks, you can feel baby moving quite a bit already. She's kicking and moving. So one morning I woke up and there was no movement. So just to be on the safe side, I called my doctor and I said, you know, I mean, at first I tried a few things. I just lay quietly just to see what was happening. You know, maybe I was stressed or something. So I tried all that. Then I came to work and she was still not moving. So I called my doctor and she's like, oh, just come in for a check and we'll see what's happening. So everything was, you know, everyone was calm. Nobody thought anything. Then I drove myself to the doctor. So first they did where they checked the fetal heartbeat. So I had to go down to actually the delivery unit. So I was there, sitting there, and you could hear these newborn babies crying. And I was sitting there alone in the room. And because it's a delivery room, so they had the little cot for the newborn babies and everything. So I was just looking at the room thinking, oh, okay, so this is how it's going to be when the time comes. Anyway, so I was sitting there, and the nurse struggled for a bit, but she's like, oh, okay, I can hear a very faint heartbeat. No, we're fine, we're fine. So then I went up to see my doctor. Then she started doing the scan, but there was no familiar doop-doop sound. It was just silence. So, yeah, I just remember I think I burst into tears. I don't actually remember. I just remember seeing the panic face of my doctor. I just couldn't understand. She was trying her best to just move the scanner all around my tummy, but yeah, there was no movement. The baby was, you know, usually you'll see her swimming and wriggling about, but she was just still and there was no heartbeat. I think my doctor, poor thing, bless her, she was in a state of shock. Then we just went and sat in her office, just kind of staring blankly at each other. Then she told me, you know, I think you better call your husband and just talk to him. He unfortunately was quite far away, so I kind of wandered the hospital alone for about more than an hour, I think almost 2 hours, just trying to process it, but not processing it as well. And because, you know, you're a heavily pregnant woman, well, not heavily, but 26, you're quite big already. So everybody is like looking at you like, oh, you know, I must be nice to this lady, give her away and everything. But I was just kind of sitting there blankly staring into space. Then when my husband came, we went up to see our doctor again. And then she gave us our options. She said, you know, since there's no heartbeat and, you know, if there's nothing we can do, you know, you can take your time and just, you know, when you feel like you're ready to come in to induce the birth, then you could. She told me I could do it anytime, but we both my husband and I said we'll do it the very next day. So then we went home, and then we had to have the wonderful task of telling our families that this had happened. So what happened the next morning? My husband and I went early. They did some, took some blood tests, and they tried to do all sorts of things, which later we found out there was absolutely no reason that could be found. It was not like it was the cord. It was not like there's something wrong with my placenta. It's just apparently there's always 1% of you will never know why you lost the baby. And unfortunately, we were in that 1%. So she was a perfectly healthy baby in all other aspects. So what happened the morning after the scan? Then I had to go down to the delivery unit. This time, all the nurses were they looked at me very, very, I mean, as soon as I walked in, there was a hush, there was a silence. You know, there's usually because it's all chatter and you can hear newborn babies screaming as they're born. But when they saw me, it just went into silence. And they were very sweet to me. They were very kind. But there was that look of, you poor thing. Yeah, so then my doctor gave me, my memory fails me now, but I think she gave me a couple of pills to take, which would then start, the contractions would start and, you know. So the rest of the day was actually, so this was in the morning. This was about 9, I suppose, 9 or 10. The rest of the day was spent actually going into labor, and then the contractions was started. So it's like going through a normal birth. So contractions start, and then the pain, and then at about 9 something at night, my little girl was born asleep, as they say. So when I delivered her. Again, my husband had gone home to feed our dogs because it was, you know, he had been in the hospital the whole day. And we did have these two other kids at home. So he was not there. And the family was all waiting outside. And it was quite awful because I was sitting in this silent room by myself. And I knew that just a few meters away was the body of my first child. They didn't want, I could hear, like, after I delivered her and the nurses were cleaning her up, I could hear them, like, so sweet, you know, very quietly they were whispering and they were just like going so many times I heard that. And but they didn't bring her to me yet because I think they're waiting for my husband. And finally when my husband arrived, he came in and my doctor came as well, and then she brought the little baby to us. And I think up till that point I hadn't cried at all that whole day, but just seeing her, this perfect little thing. She was tiny. She was about 800 grams only, but she was just beautiful and just perfectly formed. And she was a spitting image of her father. Tiny fingers, beautiful red lips. Just such a gorgeous little thing. But no cries. Just still. She like a sleeping baby. Just a sleeping baby. No movement. And yeah, so it was just the two of us. Just kind of looked at her. And then we had a few moments, a few more minutes with her. And then the doctor came in, the nurses came in to go away. I think they gave me some sleeping pills to help me sleep. And by the next morning, I was discharged with my baby to send her for her burial. In very different ways. I guess everybody was more worried about me because obviously I carried her and I suppose I had the most connection with her. I went into depression, I won't lie. I had 2 months off from work and I was alone at home most of the time. Thankfully, I had my dogs. So it was hard because you are a perfectly healthy person. I mean, I did have to go through the whole recovery process after a birth. But in all other aspects, I was perfectly healthy. My mind was there and I had nothing to do. I had nowhere to go. I had to stay at home. I remember my husband, though, he would sneak me out like during the so-called confinement period. We snuck out for a couple of movies here and there just to get out of the house. But yeah, it was just a lot of being together, just not really talking about it, but just being there for each other. And but it, because you know how your hormones are all out of whack after you deliver, so it was very hard. Sometimes I would be really angry, sometimes I'd be crying, sometimes I would be okay, but most of the time I just kept to myself and I stopped taking phone calls. I didn't really want to talk to people because it's hard to talk to people about it, because everybody, I think the worst thing was people telling me this is God's will. That to me was the stupidest thing you could say, because it didn't bring any comfort and it made you feel very angry. So that was tough. That was tough. As soon as I had my next checkup with the doctor, about 2 weeks after that, she said, you can travel. I did. I went to visit family overseas. Just to be away from the home, just to be away from the sad faces, everybody giving you that, oh, you poor thing look, which I know is very well intentioned, but at that point when you don't quite have control of your emotions, you just want to slap everybody. What I had to do was I went online. That was the place that I went to. And then I found communities there. So I didn't actually reach out to anybody, but I just read other ladies' stories of losing their babies in a similar manner, you know, stillborn after a certain 25 weeks, 26 weeks. So reading that and just knowing that, yeah, you're not alone. Because obviously when you lose a baby in that manner and there's no reason, you start to doubt every single thing that you did during the pregnancy. You're like, did I work too much? Should I have been cleaning the house like that? Should I have been bathing the dogs? You know, maybe I should have just taken it easy. Those sorts of things come into your mind. So just reading these blogs or entries or articles about how sometimes it just happens, you know, even if it's the best pregnancy, you did all the right things, it can just happen. So yes, I really do think a community would really, really have helped. I remember when after I lost this baby, my doctor was like, no, you just try again. You can try now. Just do it. And I was like, no, not in a million years. She's like, no, you don't give up. That's what she said. But when I did eventually get pregnant the second time, there was a lot of fear, both on her part and my part. And she actually very, very kindly used to see me every 2 weeks just to make sure nothing went wrong. Yeah. So there was a lot of fear in the second pregnancy. Yeah. The other issue I find with losing a baby in this manner is that people are a bit afraid to acknowledge it. So like, for example, now I have a beautiful daughter. Her name is Sita, right? Everybody asks, is this your first? And so I used to say, no, she's not. My eldest passed away. She was stillborn at 26 weeks. But the horror on the faces of the others has made me stop doing that. And that also makes me feel bad for, because I feel like I'm not acknowledging my actual firstborn. Yes, she was born asleep, but she was my first child. Acknowledge her. That's all I'm saying, because she was alive, if only in my tummy, but she was alive and she was a part of our life and she will be a part of our lives forever.
You know, in talking with Mahaini and Juliet, I was close to tears just speaking with them. But the one thing I found consistent in my conversations with them was that there is a need to educate people about death, especially child deaths.
And also, I guess, how our own fears prevent us from being truly supportive of parents who've lost their children. I think undoubtedly one of the most important messages that came through from these conversations that you've had with Mahaini and Juliet was just how much of a need there is for caregivers and friends and family to appreciate and understand the role that conversation plays in acknowledging that loss and how that plays into the larger narrative of how the rest of society perceives or reacts to the loss of a child.
Absolutely. The more we open up about it in whatever way we're comfortable with, the more society will shake off the taboo that comes with it. You know, to start, I would encourage you to get a copy of the book Caring for Marissa, the book Mahaini wrote about her daughter, which she published shortly after her passing. She's very descriptive in her book. You know, there are good moments and then there are the real difficult moments, and she held nothing back about the raw emotions all of them went through. Mahaini told me that many grieving parents actually reached out to her after that. Some would request to meet her for a chat about their experiences, but there were some who preferred writing to her without expecting a reply because, you know, all they needed was to share their story and know that someone out there was listening and someone out there cared for them.
A very big thank you to our guests, Dr. Denise Turner, Mahaini Mustafa and Juliet Jacobs, for sharing your thoughts and your stories with us this evening. You've been listening to Parenting Adventures with Caroline Oh and Arlene Weber. Join us again next week, right here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.